So close. Almost. Hey, folks. Thanks for tuning into the BAMP podcast. I'm your bespeckled host, Mike Lafferty, and we are here for our doing these more and more Sunday night Kickstarter promotion shows. Talking to Mr. James Kerr. Hey, James.
Hello. Yeah.
Frequent co-host Walt Billiard is with us, and I'm going to play our artisanally crafted sensei. Walt is with us. Going to play our artisanally crafted homegrown intro music. One second. That assures you, gentle readers, gentle listeners, and viewers, you're listening to a high-quality, high-production-value podcast. And now, just to set the tone for the show, let me share a little bit of video from back in the day.
Oh, it hurts.
It hurts.
Dragon has sanctioned an ancient rite of combat known as the Kumite. Open only to the world's most lethal warriors. It has never been won by a Westerner. You are not Japanese. I can do it now.
The first... Oh, God. I know it's cheesy, but I love that movie. And I'm guessing you do too, James, because you list it as one of the big inspirations for Fight to Survive.
It's definitely one of the big inspirations for Fight to Survive. It's I love that movie too, foibles and all, lack of connection on the hits and all, it's a good. I enjoy it a lot. Part of that is a love of Stan Bush, but certainly, Jean-Claude Van Damme always gets it for me. I love that movie. So. How do you want to say? How do you want to get into this? Do you want me to talk about my love of Bloodsport, or do you want to talk about the game?
Well, you know, we pride ourselves on very subtle and elegant segues.
Oh yeah. Okay. Podcast. Well, okay. So let me do it this way. So I was watching Bloodsport, in 1988's Bloodsport, and there's a scene where he's on the bus, and it's singing Stan Bush, it's singing like On My Own or something, and he's quietly sitting on the bus, Frank Dukes, played by Jean-Claude Van Damme, and then he looks over and he thinks he sees his enemy, Chung Lee, in the reflection of the window, and then he has to look over across the bus and he's not there. So he's feeling haunted by his enemy. And I remember thinking, like, why can't you do that in a tabletop role-playing game? Like, I really like the fighting. I have a history with fighting, but most tabletop role-playing games will give you fighting. Why can't we have something that seats you in the context of what it is to be a martial artist living in the 20th century and kind of bring home these plots that are often maligned and cheesy, but are done with a straight face? So there is definite appeal there. How can we bring that into a structure where it becomes relevant? And to have the emotional side, the heart of martial arts movies, and make the fighting in some way relevant. Because this game is born out of several layers of dissatisfaction. And one of them is that martial arts is never presented very well in tabletop role-playing games. It's either way too heavily abstracted as to be kind of meaningless, or it's a collection of superpowers, or I could cite examples, but Eric Wujek's Ninjas and Super Spies is a really good example. You've got dozens and dozens and dozens of martial arts. You can argue about how on point they are, but some of them are very on point. But you need to know an incredible amount about the martial arts in order to get anything from those, in order to really derive meaning from those mechanics. And one of the things I kept hitting up against was saying, oh, I'm going to do a martial arts game. People saying, oh yeah, I love that. I love Bloodsport, but I don't know martial arts. And so I wanted to make a game that would hit the design goals of, let's have that Jean-Claude Van Damme bus scene. Let's have the emotional relevance and the context of that kind of structure to give these fights meaning. Let's make a fight structure that's fun to play. That means you don't have to know martial arts in order to do it. But you could derive more enjoyment from it, perhaps, or more depth from it, perhaps, if you have an awareness of martial arts. And so those were the kind of the design goals going into Fight to Survive. This is not my first role-playing game. I've been in the industry for about 4 years. Most of my work has been at a Pendlehaven Press, which is Canadian. I'm Canadian as well. They do the Fate of the Norns system, which is a rune system, you pull runes instead of rolling dice. And I did several adventures for them. I did a bunch of writing, a bunch of editing, a bunch of layout work. And then on their last book, Children of Eru, which is a core book for their Celtic world, I did just a little bit of everything. I did some writing, did a lot of editing. I was the project manager for the book and for the Kickstarter, and did some design work. So I thought, well, you know, here's a whole bunch of games on my shelf, so to speak, that have been kicking around conventions for years. Fight to Survive has been done for since 2015. And I had to put it on hold because I was doing other things in publishing. During the day, I work as a magazine publisher, and then at night I was doing role-playing games. And then I had a kind of a break because of COVID and thought, well, let's do this. Let's do Fight to Survive. Let's make this happen. It's a hard sell because it's a weird system and it's a weird content. Like I can get through to martial artists, I'm sure, like Walt. it's a niche system, and I'm hoping that I can get some people behind it.
Well, I mean, just talking about genre emulation, I think people are, I've seen several games in the last couple of years are going for 80s, 90s cheesy action movie emulation. And that, as you point out, isn't always about emulating real life, but it's more like the feel of, say, that scene you describe in Bloodsport.
Yeah, the kind of hyper reality that's portrayed in American action films from like the 1970s to the mid 90s isn't really anything that has a direct allegory in history, but certainly not the stories of Frank Dukes. But it's really interesting stuff, right? Like, and it's very interesting stuff, and the kind of plot conventions of it are very genre unique. I don't know if you're familiar with Greg Stafford's King Arthur Pendragon, which is a tabletop role-playing game. It rides a really amazing line of let's do history. Like you could die of disease, you could die in childbirth, you don't go out in the winter, blah, 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 blah. And bring in the kind of hyper-reality that was made by the fantasy elements like La Morte d'Arthur, right? So how can you both service history and service kind of a more heady content without it becoming like, you know, I don't know, Knights of the Round, the 1993 cartoon about a football player is ported back in time, you know. So the point is you can have something that's colorful without it being ridiculous. So I wanted to focus on things like high kicks as being wow and not like hurling fireballs like Street Fighter II. Now, I got to say, I love Street Fighter II. I was all Ontario for Street Fighter II Championship Edition in 1994. I'm that good at it and no better. People destroy me all the time, but I didn't want this to be that. I wanted this to be like the bar fight in Best of the Best,
you know. Hey, there we go. That's what it's on our screen right now.
I know. So the kind of structure of it had meaning, kind of like how people have really latched onto Cobra Kai. Cobra Kai is a perfect example. Like Cobra Kai is my one example, and The Warrior is the other example that's on TV right now, which is, let's not just do martial arts, because we can do martial arts. Let's do martial arts in the context of some genre conventions, set up really creative and interesting structures, and give these characters who are martial artists meaning and distinction. And you don't have to throw fireballs to do that.
Remember that Street Fighter game? Maybe it was the first generation, where there was a pad on the arcade stand-up that you could punch.
Yeah, Street Fighter 1. So they had three different levels of, you had to, those things hurt my hand like you wouldn't believe.
Yeah, that got destroyed so quickly at the arcade every time there was a new one in. But that was a lot of fun. But I actually have a buddy who was an extra in Best of the Best 2 or 3.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he got to play a thug who screamed white power in the background.
Oh, God. He's, not a call to fame, but...
He's embarrassed about it to this day. But it's like his sensei at his karate dojo was friends with one of the guys who knew the producer, blah, blah, blah. So, all right. Well, I think this... My wife has been a huge fan of Cobra Kai, by the way. I meant to bring that up just because I watch whatever TV my wife wants to watch. That's how our relationship is. Yes. So I've seen a lot of Cobra Kai. And I'm a smart husband, James. I learned to watch close enough that I can ask questions. So it looks like I'm watching a lot more closely than I actually am. This is a survival skill. But actually, it's an I love the original movie. And they throw in enough nods to that, I can kind of, you know, hang on and be cool with it. But so you mentioned, as far as combat system, how are you emulating those kind of fights in the genre in your game?
Well, I started with a quote by Bruce Lee, which says, unless a human being has six arms and six legs, I'm paraphrasing, they're going to fight like a human. So every character has five moves that are you're just going to get for being human, which is grapple, punch, kick, block, and footwork. And then they kind of do a rock, paper, scissors. Now, block and footwork don't do damage, so it's a little bit more intricate than that. So there's a little chart on the character sheet to keep track. But generally speaking, kick beats punch, because you outrange somebody. Punch beats grapple because you break it with pain. And that's the kind of structure you work on. And then as you get going, you kind of memorize these structures. So every round you come up with usually three moves. You're like, I think I'm going to punch. I think I'm going to kick. I think I'm going to maybe kick again. Sure. And then as it's a call and response, as somebody gives a move, you give a move in response. And then once your moves are exhausted, you see who gets hit. This is very quick, very fast. Rounds are best 2 out of 3. It doesn't matter if it's like in the streets or at a tournament or whatever, because it's mostly just miserable street fighting. And that resolves combat. So it works very well. It's intuitive. Each of the moves has two different kind of markers on it. One is technique, which is how well you do it, which breaks the ties involved. So if I'm throwing a kick and you throw a kick in response, I'm like, well, who has the better kick? Oh, you have the better kick. Okay, your kick threads are on mine. And then force is how much impact it does on the character. So what distinguishes martial arts in this case is not the moves themselves, because we stick to those five moves. It's the training regime. It's how much bonus you get to the technique or to the force when you're training. So it becomes easy, but not necessarily preferable to train in lots of different martial arts. So you end up with a career that's kind of similar to what somebody's martial career would be. Oh, you know, I did karate for 5 years and Goju Ryu karate, and then decided I wanted to try something different. So I went on a BJJ, and then I did that for about 3 years, and then, you know, a bit of Muay Thai after that. Because what it comes down to is what your numbers are and what you get out of it and the doors that you walk through that are presented to you. And you learn through teachers, and you learn through the stages that you have in order to train in those places, and it becomes relevant. So that's kind of the combat side of things, is comparing these moves. I'll take a note though that some of it is quite a bit abstracted for the martial arts buffs in here, like Walt. It's I had to hit a kind of a line between making it understandable and intuitive and making it deeper. If I had my way, I would have named, well, I do have my way, I guess, but if I had my way, I would have named them according to ranges. So like grapple is everything from center line out to elbow distance. So it includes all the checks and anything you can do from center line. And then the punch is, because they break apart for ranges. Punch is essentially to the fist, and then kick is essentially to the extension of the kick, and then block and footwork are dealing with abstract ranges beyond that. So, you know, if you have somebody who wants to like elbow around and strike in close quarters, or even some small snap kicks would fall under punch instead of falling under kick, et cetera, et cetera. So people can get as colorful as they want to with these things. And Streets of Fire, I love that movie so much.
You mentioned that was one of your inspirations, and I was curious because I don't always think of that as a martial arts movie, or I don't really think of it as a martial arts movie. So I was kind of
okay. Here's you got to reel me in if I get too much here. So Streets of Fire was done in 1984, directed by Walter Hill. Walter Hill also directed a wonderful movie in 1975 with Charles Bronson called Hard Times, about a street fighter in 1933 drifting through New Orleans and fighting his way along. It's a great martial arts film. People don't often think of it as that way, but it's a great martial arts film. Now Walter Hill's Hard Times was effectively, all the backgrounds from it were lifted to make Street Fighter II, the video game. When he turned around and made Streets of Fire in 1984, they effectively, Capcom again, adapted it into being Final Fight. So the plot of the Final Fight video game is just Streets of Fire. Instead of Tom Cody, he's Cody. And they invented a big muscly Jesse Ventura Mayer and did it backwards. So like Walter Hill, the films of Walter Hill have this weird reciprocal relationship with Capcom fighting games and beat 'em up games that keep feeding back on itself. And everything that Walter Hill does is kind of a Western. Not that it's all good, but it's kind of a Western, and it has kind of Western sensibilities. Streets of Fire. You know, he shoots people with guns, like he shoots up the motorcycles with guns, and they have a sledgehammer fight at the end. But like effectively, it's still martial arts. It just doesn't have it follows all of the story beats and conventions of a martial arts film. It just doesn't happen to feature martial arts, and has been adapted into martial arts like content.
Okay. Walt, do you have any thoughts, any questions?
What about, now you said that, you know, the guy that goes and does 5 years of this and then 3 years of that and blah blah blah, right? What about the guy that just does one thing for a whole lot of time? Because in my experience, I've seen a whole bunch of guys that know a lot of techniques and they look really pretty doing it. They are pretty much wet bags of paper. They can't fight out of a, like, you look at some of these guys who wear black belts and they're like, I go to Ralph's studio of martial arts and I know 200 techniques. I have seen those guys get trounced time and time again by guys who know five techniques.
Well, fear not the man who knows 10,000 kicks, but the man who has practiced kick 10,000 times. Yeah. And no, I like, there's an emotional content to the game that I'm going to have to touch on at some point, because you develop a relationship with your teacher, and developing a relationship with the teacher is in, like, mechanically is how you are able to advance through their curriculum. So it's certainly not within your incentive in the game to, like, shop around. Right. But it the game takes place over a long period of time. You guys both nodded when I said King Arthur Pendragon by Greg Stafford. It similarly takes an approach of every game session is about 1 to 3 years. So you end up advancing in through the decades of the 20th century in a kind of martial lineage, and get a kind of overview of what's going on, and then the deep dive into the action, so to speak. So you end up wanting to stick with your teacher because you're a part of their life, right? And they're a part of your life. Does it have a mechanical advantage? Well, the difference in mechanics is that you are become more focused on particular aspects of training. So, for instance, if karate is going to give you a bonus to train block, and you stick with, not that all karate does, but and you stick with karate, it will continue to give you a bonus to training forms and incentivizing that number getting higher and higher and higher. I'm using a bit of trickery here that, like, there's no reason for that technique number to get higher and higher and higher beyond a certain threshold. It's just that you're always convinced that the other guy is going to come out and get you. So you keep training.
Like they do.
Well, there's always someone tougher, right? So you keep training and raising that ceiling and raising that ceiling. And you're like, well, I'm gonna make sure that I can always block. And the game had some wonderful side effects in playtesting, because it's been in playtesting for a long time, blind playtesting for a long time, because you have to do that with the system. You can't, like, I'm astounded by the designers who are like, oh yeah, I played it in my home game and, you know, just started. No,
it's I played it with six guys I've known since high school, and I loved it.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's funny, they like all my stuff. I don't know why. It must be great. No, so it has the side effect that if you train in defensive techniques like block and like footwork, I had to downplay kind of the role of footwork leads in actual life, because, you know, good footwork will almost always will get you out of it no matter what, and I need to provoke conflict. But the nature of getting good at block and footwork, I had a playtester tell me, like, oh, you know, I put everything into block and I don't understand. Like, I just can't seem to really, like, win the fight. Like, I'm never getting hit, but I don't know why it's not. And I'm like, okay, come on, guys. Like, let's just develop your offensive techniques. Like, you need force. You're not getting anywhere because you don't need force. Like, you've got embroidered fists. Let's step it up. So, I mean, you have a more extensive background than I do, Walt, but what I just trained in Kung Fu for a couple of years. I've done some sporadic teaching of a few different forms of Kung Fu, of Yin Yi, Yang style Tai Chi, Chen style Tai Chi, a little bit of Bagua. So mostly like soft Kung Fu styles, although I have done a bunch of Lo Han Kuan and Mizong Lo Horn, which is like a lost tribe monk style. It's just a variation on the Tom Toy techniques for Lo Han.
So you packed all of this into a couple of years?
I'm 40, guy.
Well, no. You said you trained in Kung Fu for a couple of years.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, by a couple of years, I mean, like, I don't know, 15 years.
Oh, okay. That's not a couple. That's
yeah, but it's minor compared with, like, I'm sure you know people and I know people who, like, you know, have been, like, for me, that's a smorgasbord, right? Like, really, that's a smorgasbord. But the people who buckle down and are like, yeah, I've been doing this Tom Toy for, you know, 20 years. I'm like, well, you're going to murder me. Like,
yeah. Do you know who Steve Watson is out of Connecticut?
Have
you
ever heard? Sorry. No, I'm up in Canada. So I'm,
well, he's known on the international circuit. He's done, the push hands, championships in China and stuff like that. And won.
that's amazing. Yeah. No, the people who can do push hands really well, are terrifying. You know, that kind of subtlety. I'm like, I don't even know what my own body's doing.
Yeah, it's funny because, like, when I go to like a seminar or something like that, they'll sit there and be like, oh, you know, push hands, and, you know, it's all about the energy, and Mr. Watts is very good, because he's like, we all need to remember the number one rule that anybody learns how to fight with their hands and feet is to impress girls. You know, so, like,
chicks,
you know,
get chicks.
Yeah, you know, you all goof around, and, you know, and you know, you sit there and you're having a conversation after, and he's like, oh, you know, you, you're experienced in, you know, Japanese martial arts, Filipino martial arts. He goes, what do you think would be the best object for you to overcome, say, somebody who's really sensing your energy and blah, blah, blah. And I said, oh, that's easy. I said, you wouldn't stand a chance against me. And he's like, oh, because, you know, la, la, la. I said, no, I'd shoot you from 15 feet. All your kung fu means nothing to a gun, bro. And I said, and if I don't have one of those, I have a rock I can freaking tie into a sling and throw it at you. You know, so it's like it's all about, you know, it's all about knowing that other guy and knowing, you know, where you stand on because if I see somebody doing some like magic push hands on somebody and just like, because like I tangled push hands with that guy, couldn't move him, couldn't touch him.
Empty jacket.
Yep. That's what it, you know, and I'm like, yep, this, you're the reason guns were involved.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, like, I have no illusions about guns. Like, I'm not a boxer rebellion.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
But within the context of the game, though, like, you really want to see Jean-Claude Van Damme kick the gun out of the guy's hand, right? So, like, it's trying to come up with, like, I had a rough childhood, right? I grew up in a small town, got into a lot of fights. And fights are terrible. They're horrible. They're sickening. It makes you sick to your stomach. And like you fear for your life and, you know, one wrong hit and you could just lose the ability to smell. It's not great. It's not fun stuff.
Show enough.
But it happens, you know? And I wanted to kind of deal more responsibly. Like it sounds like a contradiction given everything I've said, but I really wanted to deal more responsibly with the nature of violence and how much it has a kind of glory and allure, but it also, it's like, it's really bad. Like, you know, getting into a fight in your living room because your roommate had a bad drug deal or something. And like, you know, you're throwing guys through plaster. Like it's not good. And on one hand, I don't want to glorify that. And on the other hand, like, there's some really great movies out there. so how do you deal with that responsibly from a design perspective, right?
Well, that's the thing with gaming in general. Yeah. You know, we have to understand that you're playing a game. You're not you're not trying to glorify anything. If you have somebody who's you know, the raiding party is trying to defend a town against orcs, that's what you're doing. You're playing a game town to defend orcs. If you're playing a kung fu game where, you know, Jean-Claude Van Sniff does his threaded super flying split kick in the air and stuff like that. You know, number one, if you live in one of those rougher neighborhoods, you know, if you try one of those kicks in real life, they're going to feed you the pavement.
Now you got
to
stay there so you can do all three helicopter kicks.
Right, exactly.
You got to wait there. You can't get knocked back far enough in the first. No. Okay. So like, how do you marry those two ideas? And guns are a really good example because you can just whip out a gun and you can just shoot somebody. We talked about Streets of Fire as an influence. He's whipping out a gun all the time. So how can we make that relevant and how can we make that interesting? So in the game, the structure of grapple, punch, kick, block, footwork is repeated with guns in different kinds of aiming and stuff that you can do with a gun. And it's repeated for an outnumbered group so that you could potentially recreate, you know, the Fist of Fury scene where Bruce Lee comes in into the Japanese dojo, like in a mechanically relevant way. That's not going to be a nightmare to run as a GM because I only have so much storage capacity. I can only run so much. And it's repeated for like improvised things. So you can kind of cross contextualize these things. So if somebody with a gun is trying to aim and shoot, that's like a punch to a gun, and you choose kick, which beats punch, and that kicks it out of their hand. So it becomes very quick. It's a conceptual like kind of jump coming for people coming from D&D or something that's a little bit more traditional, but it works very well, a system of moves trumping moves, because I mean you've already got it right. Well, like it's a I don't think you have any trouble with it, but. So how do you deal responsibly with violence and get to have the fun of like kicking a gun out of somebody's hand, which, you know, is probably just going to make them move their hand back and then they move it back and shoot.
Well, the other side of it too, is that even, you know, some of those movies, there are some directors out there who have really loved those movies back in the day. And they showed that violence should be the last resort, but if you have to resort to it, there are levels that you can take. And if you've been involved in law enforcement or like military at all, you know that there's an escalation of force that a lot of time are taught in these places. Like one of the best movies that have come out in the last 15 years in regards to martial arts is a movie called Red Belt. And just the idea of this guy constantly trying to say, hey, listen, violence is a solution, but it's not necessarily the solution that you want because there's consequences on both sides, you know, and that really plays. And if you can accommodate that at the table, that only the strong, if you love capoeira, right?
Yeah.
That is just,
and Mark Dacascos.
Yep. You know, that is just one of those movies where you watch it. And even though you have the, there's Red Belt right there. Yes. Yeah, that movie is fantastic. If you have not seen that movie, you really, really, really owe it to yourself.
You're getting a watch list from this podcast here.
Right. But like Only the Strong is one of those movies where you sit there and you watch it. And yes, there's some conflict because there's gang violence involved. But at the end of it, you know, you see that the capoeiristas in the groups that the maestre deals with, they have such an amazing sense of community, you know? Mm-hmm. So like you sit there and you get that there's more to martial arts than just punch. Like I know tons of guys, I'm a former Army guy, and I know tons of guys who get out of the military and they feel lost. They do not have that sense of discipline. They don't have that sense of camaraderie-ship. And it's like, dude, come down to the gym. Let's throw some hands. Let's do some Brazilian jiu-jitsu. Let's do this. Let's do that. You know, because that sense of community is there as well. So, I mean, you know, if you have those things in your game, you know, balancing that violence becomes very easy because it's almost intrinsic to the kind of experience you have at the table.
Well, I'll tell you what the structure is. So every character has some comforts, some people, places, and things that they care about. So, and it could be anything really, like, but a common person is your teacher, but you could also have students, or you could have your school, or you could have your girlfriend, Cindy. And then places, you know, you could have a stage, which is where you go and people meet you. It's kind of corny, but like the idea, you know, like the old pier down by the dock, you know, everybody yep. knows that you can meet you down there. Or it could be your school, or it could just be your apartment. And a thing, it could be like a pocket watch given to you by your grandfather. It could be like your sports car. It could be your whatever. The point is that those are the things that help you, because you've got two kind of main tracks. You've got your health track, which, you know, if it goes off the rails, then you're dead. And you've got a hardship track, which you add to every time something happens that's not great in your life, you know, that you encounter hardship. And if the hardship track feels similarly, then you're out of the game. You quit. You're like, you quit this martial lifestyle. You quit this life of violence. You don't want any part of it anymore. What prevents you from doing that is you employ your comforts, each of which have a number. So maybe you put like 3 in your girlfriend and like 5 in your teacher and 2 in your stage. And so there are times in the game, which is pretty regimented, when you go and you're like, my hardship is getting too much. And so you go for a drive in your sports car, and like mechanically that reduces the hardship. So you're willing to get back into the fight. Every game is encapsulated by one of those comforts being under threat. Like if you put it down, then it's on the chopping block, so to speak, for all the characters. So like your girlfriend, Jenny, she's just been kidnapped. That's how we're going to start off 1951. Like you need to go rescue Jenny. If you don't rescue Jenny, then everything you put into Jenny is going to go into your hardship, and that may crack you. So people are incentivized to try and chase down their whatever is driving the action in order to not suffer such hardship. Similarly, fights are deadly. Like, and you're more likely to have a kind of a sustained injury over a long period of time than you are to. Because it deals with a series of check boxes that kind of have different rules as you progress up the brackets. And you could have something sitting on that bracket filled in for potentially years and be like, oh, that's the old shoulder injury that never healed well. Like I'll do this because you're around, Walt, and I can share war stories. But like I was in a backyard one time with a guy who was Olympic qualified in judo.
That's a bad move.
I thought I was hot stuff. I was like, okay, let's do this. And anyway, I guess it's not a great story, but the point is, I thought I tapped out. He didn't think I tapped out. He kept turning, and the parts of me didn't turn. And that shoulder, still aches on rainy days. It was great. But the point is, things can stay with you. And for stupid reasons, they can stay with you, injuries, right? And it doesn't matter how well you treat them sometimes, they're just kind of always going
to
be there.
Well, that makes the character a lot better. I mean, you hear stories, you go to seminars and stuff like that, and you hear about guys like Jean-Jacques Machado, right, out of Brazil. And, you know, he you hear the training stories of like guys coming up and they're like, you know, they're high-fiving each other and yelling out thank you, and you're trying to figure out what the hell, they keep thanking each other, right? Then you roll with the guy, and you if you get him in a good move, he taps, you know, and he says, oh, thank you. So, you know, you eventually roll around and ask him, and you're like, hey, what's up with this? And he's like, you know, by you exposing that weakness in my technique, I can improve. So thank you. You know, and it, just the humility and stuff like that. But then you got those other guys, you know, that are being seen by the medic off to the side. And what's, and you know, what happened to him? He definitely didn't say thank you. You know what I mean? He was that guy that you're not going to tap me. You're not going to submit me. You're not going to dislocate my shoulder. I'm so tough. And that's the way it is. And it's just like, bro, that's not how this works. You know?
Well, and you know, you'll be interested in the health mechanic. Well, because I wanted to do something that there's a series of three check boxes called bruised. And there's a series of three check boxes called like beat up. And then a series of three called knocked out. You get hit, you get one damage. Like if it's just a normal blow, you put it in the first mark of bruise. You're like, okay, I'm bruised. I got a bruise. When you get hit again, you can choose to put it right next to there to be even more bruised, or you can choose to move up a bracket. The trick is that all of the first brackets are easy to recover. All the second brackets are really hard to recover. And all the third brackets, you're good luck trying to recover them. So you can go right up to knocked out after three hits and just black out. So it's using knocked out the way getting knocked out, you know, functions, is to try and save you, which I think is a first in a role-playing game, honestly, if I'm going to say anything. So you get to choose that moment when you're getting hit, and you choose subconsciously, I guess, sometimes consciously, am I going to stay in this fight? Is this worth it? Like, or am I just going to go down? Like, and sometimes the right answer is to go down, and sometimes the right answer is to stay in. But you know, you get to that certain point where you've expended that energy, and it becomes harder and harder to choose to stay in if you haven't already like buckled yourself down. And I really wanted to emulate that, the way it feels to be like, to make those decisions of like, well, I'm screwed, or okay, I think I've got this, but like I've got to bear down, or you know.
So like in the beginning, when you're setting up a game, right, and everybody starts picking their different styles and stuff like that, right, is it all people from one crew, like all people from one dojo, or is it like everybody getting together like that movie Triple Threat, where it's like this, or Force Five from back in the 70s, where it's like, yeah, this is a master of kung fu, this guy's a karate
I love
guy.
Force Five, Benny, right? The Jet should have done more movies.
He was too busy teaching seminars making five.
No, it's fair enough. He was too busy being one of the best kickboxers in the world forever. But yeah, it's
but like,
so the point is, you can go either way. You can,
yeah,
go either way.
Like, the question I had in that was like for example, you got a karate school, mm-hmm. right? Say you got a karate school that doesn't teach the old weapons, right? It's just straight up like Cobra Kai, right? And hopefully they have better karate than Cobra Kai has.
Well, that's Tong Sudo, really.
Oh God. Well, I mean the original of what do you call it? They had Fumio Demura doing the choreography originally, mm. you know, but the stuff that they have in the TV show now is just abysmal. But the say you got like a Cobra Kai gym, you know, that's straight up kickboxing, and then you have the guy that knows Hagana, right? He comes in after a tour in the military. He just needs somebody to train, somewhere to train, but he's the only thing he's really trained in is Israeli knife fighting. You know, where does he fit into this particular game session?
Okay, so are we talking about where how the two characters can connect and interact?
Well, no, like do you just say, oh yeah, he just got back from Israel and he's a what do you call it, a knife fighter? You know, and he's
no,
just
I mean having... I've got 50 something martial arts in the game right now. And I wanted to keep it simple. I wanted to keep it so that people could pick it up and play without having to know like the difference between you know, Northern Praying Mantis and Southern Praying Mantis.
Right.
I ultimately went with Wang Lang versus Chow Gar. But anyway, so I've got like five introductory kind of user-friendly martial arts, kind of fronting it. And then if you want to, you can get deeper, which is, you know, boxing, kickboxing, karate, kung fu. And I use that even though it's a dirty term. And wrestling, right? Like, and so you have a kind of, and then if you want to go any deeper into kung fu, here's the, you know, 40 kung fus. Because it's an inadequate umbrella term, but I talk about that in the text, right? Like, is that you can't.
And is it all just Asian martial arts?
God, no. I mean, it's the whole world, right? I've got like, I didn't want to go crazy, and I can in expansion books, but I wanted to kind of touch on everything, you know, like I've even got, I'm going to say it wrong, but Ojitawa, which is like a Cree martial art, from Ontario. You know, there's a fellow like fairly locally actually who teaches that.
Oh, no doubt. That's cool.
Yeah. And, it's fairly, I don't want to say it's comprehensive because like I've got, this is kind of the mechanical overview Fight to Survive. Like this is everything that you can do with it. And then I've got a whole bunch of like a whole line of expansion books for kind of splitting off and trying to get deeper into the martial arts, because I know that people don't have most people don't have quite the threshold for like the academic, deep dive that I would want to do. You know, I can't pull people aside and be like, okay, so Bodhidharma, let's start
there. Oh God.
You know, like, but it allows me to make it kind of front friendly. Like people know the difference between boxing and wrestling and whatever. And then you always have one guy in at a convention typically who's like, I want to do Krav Maga. And then you're like, okay, here's the rules for Krav Maga. Let's go. So how do they work together? How the player characters work together is to a certain extent is decided by the player characters. I found that most player characters, they have to be connected by a comfort. So you have to at least share at least one comfort with one other person. So you might have decided that this one person is both of your fathers. So then you become brothers. So you might decide that you've both owned this sports car. Or you might decide that you're both dating this girl. Or you might decide that however you want to split it up. Or you could both have the same martial art. That's fine, right? And whether you're from the kind of same school, I've never had that happen among player characters, or whether you're from rival schools, which have happened quite a bit, that's up to you. You're kind of united under the sense of shared fellowship in the quote-unquote martial world, because it's not easy to get, how do I put this, in Dungeons and Dragons, you have a party and you always stick together and you don't wander off because you'll get eaten by a gelatinous cube or something. Yes. Right. And it is an unspoken rule. It is not in the game, but it is the unspoken rule of the game. Don't make the GM's life hard by trying to diverge. Right. In this game, I made the conflict resolution so snappy and quick that your people are encouraged to diverge and weave in and weave out. And it's incentivized that not everyone participates in the combat, because I wanted it to be the case to emulate the genre source material that not everybody's going to fight every combat. So the way that you get a training point to then later advance in your techniques is by not fighting.
Oh, classic.
So you stand by observing and you drink your beer or whatever as you're watching the bar fight, and then if it gets really ugly, you're like, you know what, and you get to jump in. But people are incentivized to give other player characters a spotlight, a limelight, for them to create meaning through this fight, because then they're gathering up their points and they're learning and they're studying, and then they can go apply those to a training regime. Because I really wanted, like, I swear to God, it's hard to explain to people, most of martial arts is training. And how do you make that training meaningful? Well, you make it in this game, in Fight to Survive, it's made meaningful by a currency, is you're spending these training points that you've had. And the players who always throw themselves into a fight will discover two things very quickly. They're hurt a lot, and that they don't know anything. So they don't have anything to train. So they need to learn from their fellows. So mechanically, you learn from each other, and you learn from the act of doing. And that also makes it for the GM, it makes it easier to say, like, okay, well, this, you know, you busted in on the school and you two are going to fight in this, and the two of you are going to sit back and watch in case anything happens. Okay, good. And then you can resolve the conflict pretty easily. So that's how the training develops and goes on. So you might have a Krav Maga guy, and I forget what the other one you mentioned was, but like a karate guy, and they are united by the fact that they both go to Riva's Diner for pie. And Riva's Diner is a really nice place. It's an old town, you know, it's the chrome has kind of come off it and some of the neon signs don't work anymore, but they know they can go to Riva's and they can get some pie. And if they're like both an
equalizer.
Getting, yeah, exactly. And if they're both, because it's mechanically reinforced, like there's nothing in the game that doesn't have like mechanical impact. If you, if they've got big hardship and they're like, I'm like, what are you guys going to do now? Like you beat the, you know, you beat the challenge, you got overcome, you managed to rescue the typewriter that got stolen, that was your writer friend's favorite typewriter that would allow him to write the next best-selling pulp book or whatever. What are you going to do? And they're like, well, I'm going to go have pie. I'm going to go to Reeves Diner, I'm going to pie. And like, he's going to come with me. Like, we're both going to go have pie. I've got like three in Riva's Diner. Well, I've got five in Riva's Diner. Okay, you guys managed to recover that much hardship. You spend some time in Riva's Diner. It's a cold winter that year, and Riva's having trouble paying rent. We'll deal with that next year. All right, 1952. Let's go. So it keeps moving. It's snappy, and interrelationships blossom like crazy in over the course of the game. Like, so it's got like a kind of hard combat structure, but what's it, depending on the group, what sometimes completely overtakes is this notion of like of relationships of like, yeah, Cindy's your girlfriend, but you know, it's been 20 years now, and she's now the also the mother of this other character, and she's related to this over here, and it turns out that, you know, so you have these complex relationships that weave in, which allow
it's cool. It's just, all right, so we're kind of doing that Pendragon thing where every game session is like 5 to 10 years. So really, you're emulating a franchise. You're not just doing one movie. You're not doing just Rocky. You're doing the Rocky Balboa franchise, finishing up where he's training Apollo Creed's kid.
So you're creating kind of martial lineage as you progress along, which may pass to a child or may pass to a student in your school. You know, and like playing Pendragon was an inspiration for this directly, which was like, what do experienced players do when they're playing a new campaign of Pendragon? They immediately find a successor just in case they die, just in case anything else happens. Like, I'm like, I need a successor. All right, let's get married, grab her. So it doesn't have to be as direct as a familial lineage in Fight to Survive. It could be that you've got the thing of fame and your successor is somebody who picked up on your fame and wanted to follow in your footsteps. And there's structures of what passes over from one character to another in terms of a succession. So the idea is that you're getting kind of stronger as you go. So you're reaching heights that you couldn't if you were confined to one character. And if you have a strong martial lineage, then the current of what you're learning and what you're getting is stronger. And some people prefer to have that kind of strength, and some people prefer to like keep it like bare bones, because as your character ages, they get better in terms of all of their training, but they get worse in terms of their ability to take a hit and their ability to withstand it. Like your health checkboxes start disappearing and your hardship checkboxes start disappearing. So it's harder to withstand the kind of crap that you have to put up with physically and emotionally, trying to pursue a violent lifestyle, because it's all about this tension of like a violent lifestyle being attractive and a violent lifestyle being ultimately negative in a negative force in your life. If that's not too heady.
I think Walt might be the best possible co-host for that particular subject.
Yeah. I'd rather live a day as a lion than 100 years as a lamb. So give me the violence every time.
Well, it's great. I mean, you get to have like, I don't know. I didn't want to have a structure of a role-playing game with cheap glory, because there's lots of them, and it makes it feel like the stakes have gotten kind of unreasonable in some cases. It's like if every Marvel movie is about a world-ending threat, you stop caring about world-ending threats. So I wanted to take it and reel the whole thing back to, let's deal with some grassroots threats. You know, let's deal with things that are a little bit closer to home, a little bit closer to the heart, and we can care about them, and we can overcome them, and we can do that together. And that resonates with players a lot. But trying to describe to people that Fight to Survive is not a game where you throw fireballs is a considerable hurdle to getting it marketed. No, I'm sorry. They're like, I say martial arts. They say, oh, like Naruto. And I'm like, no, not like Naruto. And they're like, no, like fighting. Oh, like Fight Club. I'm like, no, not really.
I had to explain to somebody the other day. It was like, you know, we were talking about a game that my company's putting out. And they were like, you know, why don't you go with such an old expression of blah, blah, blah. And I said, you know, I said, the current slew of media and gaming and stuff like that, I said, it's like an Italian man coming to America and having an American sweet for the first time. I said, all he can taste is the sugar and the garbage in it. He can't taste any of the underlying ingredients. Can't taste the flakiness of the pastry. All it is sugar and garbage. I'm like, it's the same thing with, like, you know, what you're talking about, you know, like Naruto. And it's like, no, not like Naruto. First of all, if you run like that, you're just going to run into a wall. So stop being a goofball, you know. But secondly, you know, half the stuff is just the way it is because it's designed to look good on a matted cell background, you know. So that's not, you know.
There's Lionheart. I love Lionheart.
Yeah, right. So like that whole, you know, that whole, the thing that I think your game would introduce to people is, especially for fans of stuff like Naruto, is that there can be a deepness to it where you're not just doing ninja kick, you know, or anything goofy like that. You can see the richness of the martial arts instead.
Yeah, I'm not going to begrudge anybody's fun, right? Like, people have different levels of fun. And there is a time and a place for a power fantasy.
Oh,
but
yeah.
But this is not a power fantasy. And trying to explain to people that this is not a power fantasy, but there's still a lot of fun to be had in it.
Absolutely.
It is one of the challenges of trying to market this. Lionheart's a really good example. Lionheart is, as far as I'm concerned, one of the best Jean-Claude Van Damme movies. There's very few fight scenes in it. There's like 5 fight scenes in it, right? But it's actually got a really interesting relationship within the characters of, like, you know, he's got no money. He finds a manager. He kind of gets under the control and wing of this rich woman who's manipulating fights. The relationships are really there in this movie, and I feel like it really resonates. But you know, not everybody's a fan. That's okay.
Well, this is one of those genres that kind of peaked in the late 80s, early 90s, and we haven't seen, like you say, the fight movies we see these days tend to be either, you know, pure that's coming from Hong Kong, or maybe a little more sensationalized.
I mean, there are ones like Blood and Bone with Michael J. White is only.
Oh, God. You know, Michael J. White. He is so good. I love his films.
He's stupid good. But that's a good example of like a classic old martial arts movie that's only yay old, right? Like some of the stuff that Tony Jaa is doing, some of the stuff that Donnie Yen is doing is still fits within the pocket of yes, absolutely. They peaked in the mid-90s probably. I'm a huge fan of the direct-to-DVD kind of structure. Cynthia Rothrock.
Oh, God.
You know,
Cynthia Rothrock.
I think there's a wealth of stuff to explore. You know, Don the Dragon Wilson, like who's also the nicest guy on Twitter.
He really is.
Yeah. But so I really wanted to explore the martial history of what's going on. Like, I have to make all this approachable and natural and whatever, but like, I love talking to people's ear off about, like, oh yeah, the first karate school in North America was opened by Robert Trias after he went AWOL and studied under a Chinese monk in Okinawa. What's a Chinese monk doing in Okinawa? Well, it's an interesting story because people usually won't let me indulge in stuff like that. But here's the system where I get to do it. Now, I should preface, like, I've got a design background in role-playing games. I did not put a heady meta-narrative into this game because you're going to make it when you make
up like character. 900 movies to choose from.
Yeah, exactly. But also, like, just by virtue of what you choose as your comforts, you're going to make that narrative. You're going to decide what's important to you. If the, like, striking bowling alley is on your comforts because that's a place where you go and you shoot bowling balls, and that's going to be part of this narrative that's going to build. Any meta narrative that I place over that, I don't want it to trump the relevance of what's happening with your characters. I still want to be able to introduce Count Dante and be like, oh yeah, Count Dante is going to blow up this dojo and rob a bank and like, but he's got to fit within what the characters what the players are deciding to do with their game, because you know, you're as a GM, you're a participant in the game, and I want to know what people are doing. I want to know what story they develop. I hate to use the word story. I think it's false when we're talking about role-playing games. But like, I get to have the fun of playing with people and finding out what weird things they're going to do and who they're going to latch on to, because I introduce like all these opponents, and it's always the weird ones that people really gravitate towards.
Oh, yeah. So here's the question, the crowning question of the evening. you know where I'm going with this. I can feel the tension between us right now. Where do the ninjas fit in? Because 84 to like 90, there were like 100 ninja movies.
I know. And like, I want to stress that this game, like, I love the 80s. I love the 80s aesthetic. It's all over the Kickstarter. But the game takes place over the course of the 20th century, right? Like, and it could be any point in the 20th century. And some of the stuff that happens in the early 20th century with the Tong Wars and like other things are really rich historical items. And as like the scat band by General Douglas MacArthur, and as things get exploded after World War II in terms of how martial arts are migrating around the world, there's a wealth of the 20th century to explore. But I too love the 80s. And I too love Enter the Ninja and the Octagon and, you know, all the other Mike Stone, everything else, Frank Nero, you know. But how do ninjas fit in? Ninjutsu is included erroneously because that's where we, like, we're riding the line of, like, let's bring in the fun aspects of the fiction as well as trying to represent the field of what it is, right? Like, because I mean, like, we can go on a long diatribe about the nature of ninjutsu and the structure of it as a system or not as a system. Yeah. But the, you know, you've got various, like, how do I put it? I have never seen such unreliable information as I do on the Wikipedias of different martial arts. As if you ever observe any of their Wikipedias, rival histories will try and overwrite each other every 2 or 3 months. Of people who feel that is not historically accurate and their school teaches what is historically accurate, and they continue overwriting each other. There are people out there that will tell you all about how they're a ninja and they've been trained in ancient ninjutsu arts. And there are people out there which will demonstrate very nicely that this is a modern convention and that it's a modern fiction. And that's fine. So we had to come down at some point on that kind of pseudo-mythical, pseudo-historical structure and say, here's ninjutsu. Let's place it down here. And see how it floats. Because the difference in martial arts in this game is a difference in training regime. Like, it's a difference in what you're taught and what you learned. As a student, you still have to open that door. So if you get a ninjutsu teacher and you only put one into their comfort, they don't really care about you. They'll teach you the kind of surface stuff.
Yeah.
You know, you send as a ninjutsu person, like teaching, and you have a ninjutsu teacher, they don't really care about you. They'll just get you to do floor walking. You're just doing floor walking forever. So you get a bonus to footwork. Hooray. And that's not very glorious. And players are like, oh, footwork. But so just and they'll be like, what am I doing? And I'll be like, oh, you're just walking back and forth in a low squat posture, to this wall and then back to that wall. I'm like, well, then what I'm doing? No, that's what you're doing. Yeah, that's what you're doing for years. If you want more, you have to invest more in the comfort. And then the ninjutsu teacher might teach you more of its esoteric secrets. So that, cool. Like, that's the structure.
One of our favorite commenters, and we've had him on the show a couple times, Albert Zidente from Europe. Hope you're okay over there, buddy, is asking us the question that I was wondering, but not going to ask. Where does Steven Seagal fit in? And I'll let you guys, two more serious martial artists, talk about that.
It depends on what girl he's trying to impress at the time.
I like as a. Oh, you studied Aikido, Mike. Anybody can prove me wrong. Aikido, as far as because I studied a little bit of Kenjutsu, and as far as I'm concerned, Aikido has a wonderful role in disarming your opponent, and trying to bargain for an advantage in a next to impossible situation where things are very, very deadly. Would I want to use Aikido techniques in a fight? Well, I've used it in a bar fight before in small joint lock operations to trap somebody's fingers and then lead them out of the bar like a steering wheel. But would I want to use it in a fight where somebody knows they're fighting? No, I would not want to use it in a fight where somebody knows they're fighting. And the most thing I respect most about Steven Seagal is probably his ponytail. And that's the end of it. I don't know if you have more to say on Steven Seagal. Well, but...
we'll leave it at that.
I saw an interesting interview with Ed Norton on the Joe Rogan show. Ed Norton is apparently a martial arts guy, and he is into Aikido. And he was like, yeah, here's something about Steven Seagal. Yeah, he's kind of a punchline now, but back in the day, he was like one of the first Westerners who taught Aikido in Japan. And yeah. he was respected. And now I don't quite know what happened, but here we are. So.
There's a great channel. I don't remember the name of it, but it's these two dudes that sit in the couch and drink beer. and they watch Steven Seagal movies. And they started with his most early films and has been going through. And they did the sniper movie that he did not too long ago. And oh my God, I was rolling because the way he handles a rifle, you know, it's like, oh, hold on, got to move it around the belly and circumference. And
Well, Walt, I'll engage you on this. I think that there's part of why I wanted to do Fight to Survive is because martial artists are made up of some of the most caring, interesting, compassionate people I've ever known, and some of the biggest delusional jerks I have ever known.
Yes.
And
that was a beautiful segue from Steven Seagal, and I want to compliment you, sir. Please.
And I think it's important to represent kind of both sides of that attitude, is because like sometimes, you know, you're like, okay, jujitsu guy, you've got kind of a weird relationship with your teacher, but all right, like that's fine. It's always jujitsu that happens. But there are, like, Frank Dukes is a great example. Like, if you want to talk about, about Steven Seagal, talk about Frank Dukes. But you know people, as somebody who's in martial arts circles, you know people who feel that way now, who are convinced in their own mind that they can do something, or that they've got some kind of qualities that are supernatural. And it's because they, I don't know why they feel they need to, but for whatever reason they need to, and for whatever reason they've channeled their interests into martial arts. And martial arts are full of those people. And they're also filled with, like, wonderful, beautiful, genuine human beings who would like walk across hot coals in order to give you a cup of tea, right? Like I don't know any hobby that runs the gambit of polarizing people's personalities like that. But the Steven Seagals of the world are important to representing any kind of martial landscape.
One of the greatest examples of dealing with those people I've ever heard. My original exposure to martial arts was Shirinji Kempo. And the guy studied in Japan.
Kempo's a good foundation. It's a good foundation for anything.
Well, it's not Kempo like you might think of it these days. It was formed in 1967, I believe, when he finally put all his... Anyway, Shirinji Kempo transitioned into the fastest growing religion in Japan, right? But the guy's wife was like connected to old school martial arts, old school Japanese martial arts, the kind of stuff you see in the Dai Nippon Nichijen, right? The greater book of Japanese martial arts, which, by the way, ninjutsu does not appear in. I asked her one day, you know, because we were doing like some like hard training against Makiwara and stuff like that. So I said to his wife, who was Japanese, I said, Setsuko-san, why don't you guys ever practice like the hard training and the hard body training and stuff like that? And she turned around, she looked at me and she said, all that goofy stuff you and my husband do? Yeah, that all can be mitigated by either a saw or a hammer. Go away. I was like, holy Jesus. I was so blown away. And like, you know, later on when we finally convinced, because you couldn't train with her group unless you were 21 or over. So later on, we managed to get into the training. And I asked, you know, how come in this very old style of jiu-jitsu, you don't kick like your husband does? And she's like, all right, let me tell you about high kicks. High kicks exposes at least four arteries in the leg. If your opponent has a knife, you're screwed. She goes, now, here's the real reality about kicks. She goes, where do you start chopping down a tree? Do you start in the branches? Do you start at the trunk? I'm like, you start at the trunk, of course. You know, I think I was 17, 18 years old. And so, of course, I'm like, you start at the trunk. She's like, yeah, kick him in the shin. When he bends over, then you knee him in the face. She's like, don't reach up there and expose all those delicate arteries, because if they're cut, you're screwed. You're done. I was like, and she just had this like this witty battlefield kind of view of things, because that's the where the martial art came from. And it was one of those things where you're just like, there was no room for crap. You know, she's like, you know, if you get into it, because this wasn't like Brazilian jiu-jitsu where it's all grappling. You know, the first thing you do is you pick up a sword. That's how you learn grappling. And you're sitting there and you're just like, you get close and you're like, ha, I'm going to disarm you. And she's like, no, look down. Do you know what an aikuchi is, if you've heard of one of those?
Oh, sorry, no.
It's a small dagger about this long, but it doesn't have a handguard. Hey, Sparky, Rob. They usually wore them in the belt, and it was usually concealed. And she had it pointing at my femoral artery. And she's like, you know what happens when you get grappled? She's like, you're in the same distance as the other guy. I'm like, oh, crap, I suck.
Yeah, I mean, a grapple is grappling you as much as it's grappling your opponent, right? Yeah. I when I was in the Philippines, a lot of guys had pouches around their necks with curved claw knives that would just fit within their hands.
Where was that?
In the Philippines.
Oh, really? What part?
This was in Mindanao.
Oh, okay.
So a little bit farther south in the kind of rougher territory. But
yeah, I got to play in Cebu in some of those areas.
Oh, yeah. That's Cebu's gorgeous. But yeah. Yeah, so I wanted to try and capture all of that in a game and make it fun. I'm getting pretty heady into the martial arts with you because I can do that. But like, I want people to, yeah, to feel like you don't have to know martial arts. It trying to chase the real, what a fight really feels like.
Or yeah, it's boring at the table.
Yeah, it's also kind of depressing. So I wanted to create a kind of fun verisimilitude. To make it so that you can engage with it and you can have fun with the material, but you're still feeling those like hard choices and the grip and pull of violence in an interesting way. So that's what's going on with Fight to Survive. It launches on Thursday, March 24th, this coming Thursday.
Right on.
It's got a modest goal of only like Canadian dollars is $6,000. I don't know what it is in American dollars, like 5,000 maybe. And the costs are pretty cheap because I'm very selfish and I just want this done. I've got a fantastic artist and a guy named Ian McLean who's done art for Pathfinder. He's done art for Call of Cthulhu. And he's a great guy. And I've got a good editor and I've got a good sensitivity reader because this is delicate stuff culturally. And I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be great.
Do you have a landing page link I can throw in the show notes? If people are interested, they can check it out. Or should they just make a point to Google Fight to Survive on March 24th?
I'm finding Kickstarter's like Find My Coming Soon stuff to be incredibly unreliable. I would suggest people go to my website, which is RadioJamesGames.com. I'm doing a little, well, I spent 8 years in radio, so it's kind of entrenched in me. But I'm doing a little development blog where I just blather on, but also there's a link to the Kickstarter in there. Radio James Games lines up nicely, little tower. And so Fight to Survive is going to come out that way. Yeah, it's going to be a fight. Like with all Kickstarters, it's a fight. The first 24 hours are really determining. It's determining what's happening. We've got an exciting. Yeah, there it is. It's going to be really exciting. I mean, I'm a publisher, so I couldn't help it. Like the editorial's done. I'm doing the layouts anyway, so the layouts are largely done. So I'll have the quick start rules ready pretty quick. It's hard for me to figure out what to cut out of the quick start rules because the game's pretty lean. It's probably rules medium in terms of its rules complexity, but I'm accommodating the fact that it's kind of not intuitive to people. Like, it made sense to you when I said you get a training point for not participating in the fight, right? But for a lot of people, because I run this at conventions and things, they're like, what? Why? That makes no sense. I'm like, well, you're in the fight. You either already know what you need to do or you're figuring it out now, but now's not the time that you're going to learn from your mistakes. Now's the time to employ what you know or fail to employ what you know. So everybody else, they can judge you. They can stand around and figure it out. But you're throwing punches. You're throwing kicks. So that's the challenge. But I think it's a really cool game. It's only going to be like 200 pages or something. It's going to be lean, and then we'll carry on from there.
Cool. Well, this looks really exciting. I'm looking forward to the 24th, so I can beg for it. And anything else we've been talking? This time went fast. Sometimes an hour seems like forever on this podcast, but this was actually a fun conversation.
Yeah, it depends on the guest.
Well, that's true. But this was a good time. Anything else you want to cover before we wrap it up and call it a show?
Well, I'll give you a reveal, okay, which is, yeah, I haven't talked about this yet at all, and I'm going to be promoting it throughout the week, but the early bird kind of bonus for getting in early. I still don't know how many people I'm going to say, but like you know, we're in the middle of a shipping crisis. We're in the middle of an ink crisis. I didn't want to add on physical things that had to be mailed out. But what I've decided to do is run the first annual Discord Fight to Survive tournament with the first number of people who participate as a way of cheaply getting them to learn the rules quickly and then show up for this tournament and be able to exchange blows and have a really fun time. And then the winner of the tournament is going to have their name on a first place trophy in the art in the book so that they stand as the victor forever on. So the tournament, you'll get an invitation for backing early. You'll get it on the first X number of backers. I forget how many I'm going to decide on, like 32 or 64 or something, so the brackets break down reasonably. The early backers are going to get an invitation to the tournament.
Will they get like somebody showing up at the house?
unraveling a scroll like in The Quest? No, I think I'm going to email it to them. But it will be handsome looking. I promise.
Please tell me at some point Master Ken is going to be involved in this. Because that would be awesome.
I loved Master Ken in Paper Tigers. I was sad that I was planning on doing an expansion of like 70s Shaw Brothers kung fu films specifically, and I'm still going to do that. But I was going to call it Paper Tiger because I thought it was hilarious. But then the movie Paper Tigers came out, and I'm like, I have to rename it something else now. But yeah, that's one of the things that I really want to do because I have a deep and passionate love of Shaw Brothers kung fu films and Golden Harvest films that I love to explore. But that's worth a whole book on its own, right? Like this is martial arts. This is the 20th century. This is the landscape. But if you want to know more about kung fu, this is the, you know, kung fu tropes. Then this is the book. I've got like little side. There's a whole line. It's gonna be awesome.
So you're talking about like Sunday afternoon on a local TV station watching the bad English
the guy
dub,
throwing his white hair and his beard.
I don't know how you watch them. I used to go into Chinatown in Toronto and scrounge around in the bins in like small stores where nobody could speak English to try and find out something that had like the Shaw Brothers emblem on them, like the Dragon Dynasty logo, and then take them home and be like, I hope it has English subtitles. I hope it is. and then be like, yes, it's dubbed. Yes.
Alas, there was no Chinatown in Indianapolis in the 1980s. So just had to get a local non-network station that on Sundays or Saturdays was, you know, broadcasting whatever they could, horror movies or sometimes kung fu movies.
I mean, sometimes that was a great way of getting things. Like, I don't know if the show Kage no Gundam, which was one of the best ninja TV shows that ever happened. It was with Sonny Chiba. And the only English translations were broadcast in Hawaii in 1982. And it is worth tracking down like scratchy old VHS tapes of it because it was amazing. But yeah, so I go network TV, I guess.
All right, cool. Well, hey, just to wrap things up, launching on Thursday, Fight to Survive on Kickstarter, or if you go to RadioJamesGames.com, which rolls off the tongue much easier than most URLs do, you can go there and get a link to the Kickstarter start page. And sounds like a really fun game. You can back early and get in the virtual Kumite.
Yeah, there's also a Radio James Games Facebook page and a Radio James Games Discord in case you want to interact with the material or me in other ways. I'm very reachable, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that people have. I understand it's going to be a lot of fun. I want this to happen so that I can hold a virtual kumite and crown a winner. You're not going to get a katana, but you'll get a trophy on the page.
Sweet. Sounds good. James, pleasure talking to you, sir. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you guys both. It was wonderful being here.
Yeah, Walt, always a pleasure having you as a co-host.
Cheers.
Give me 1 second. I have to play our contractually obligated artisanal outro music. 1 second. All right. Thanks, folks. We'll catch you next time on the Banff Podcast.